Welcome to Open Water Chicago. This is Stephen Hernan with Open Water Chicago. Fresh off of completing an Ironman distance triathlon, Mike Solberg decided to fulfill a goal 30 years in the making by swimming the English Channel in 2009. But he also wanted to make it especially meaningful to a group of school children in Angola. In this podcast, Mike and I talk about his amazing experience and how the journey still continues, despite him having completed this monumental accomplishment. Be sure to listen in as Mike gives his special insight into what it takes to swim the English Channel and what it's like to do it for a cause. Good morning, Mike. Thank you for coming on to Open Water Chicago today.
Thank you very much.
Swimming the English Channel is an intensely personal, physical, mental, and emotional challenge. But you also decided to make this a challenge for a particular cause. Could you tell us a bit about your background and why you decided to take this particular approach when you did your channel crossing?
Yeah, the story of my English Channel swim really starts about 30 years ago when I was 15 years old and the legendary swim coach at Indiana, Doc Councilman, swam the English Channel. At the time, he became the oldest person to do it. I didn't have that goal, but when I was 15, just kind of as a young, cocky, swimming teenager, I said to myself, you know, I'd like to swim the English Channel someday.
Okay.
I didn't really have any idea of what was involved in it and what kind of commitment it was, but it has always stuck in my mind as something I wanted to do. And then, you know, flash 30 years later, or approaching 30 years later, and I realized I had a sabbatical coming up from my job as a pastor, so I would have a three-month break where I was able to pursue my own interests, get away from the job for a little while. And I realized that would be kind of a perfect opportunity to swim the channel. But then there's the obstacle of finances there as well. Luckily, I managed to apply for and get a grant from an organization called the Lilly Foundation, which supports pastoral sabbaticals. And I got this grant, and that provided the funding to, you know, basically make my dreams come true.
Terrific.
It's nice to have people give you money to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah, it was great. And so, you know, with those two biggest obstacles out of the way, time and money, I realized, all right, now's the chance. It's now or never. And so I also see my endurance training as really a bit of an indulgence. You know, when you commit that much time to something and in some ways that much money as well, it really is the temptation for it to all be about you.
Okay.
And I realized that I didn't want my English Channel swim to kind of be that sort of indulgence. I wanted to combine it with something that would benefit other people as well. And so I began thinking about what I wanted to do, and I had been to Angola about 4 years ago in 2005 as part of a church partnership with a denomination that we are partners with over there. And during that trip in 2005, you know, I just saw things and experienced things that, you know, few of us in the United States get to see. I mean, the level of need is so great in almost all of Africa, but especially in Angola, which suffered a civil war from 1975 to 2002. So when I was there in 2005, you know, they're really still just coming out of the war in great need of infrastructure development. And so when my English Channel swim started coming closer, I asked our partners over there, you know, if I was able to do something, what would you like me to do to help out? And they said, you know, almost immediately, education, build a school. And so I said, all right, what would it take? And they said about $50,000.
Okay.
And I said, oh, my gosh. You know, I had read online about lots of people combine their English Channel swim with fundraising, but as best I can tell, the results are often, you know, $2,000-$3,000 in that area. And so I knew $50,000 was a big goal, but I got a lot of contacts. And, you know, early on in the process, I really worked just as hard on the fundraising side of it as I did on the swim preparation side of it. So I put a lot of work into it, and not long ago managed to cross that $50,000 goal. So it was really wonderfully satisfying, not only to, you know, get the channel swim in, but to meet that fundraising goal as well.
Terrific. Wow. You'd mentioned, and this is one of the biggest obstacles that many people have when they decide to undertake this challenge, not only the time commitment involved, but the financial commitment, the money involved in undertaking this particular challenge.
Yeah.
Could you give us an idea of what exactly is involved with regards to that?
Well, it's a little bit different for everybody because, especially when it comes to the expenses of training, a lot depends on where you live. And, you know, like you, I'm here in landlocked Illinois. Of course, we have Lake Michigan, but in order to get in any real saltwater training, you basically have to travel 1,000 miles.
Right.
So just as far as the training goes, that varies a lot. You know, I decided that I really needed to go out to San Francisco Bay for a training trip, and so that was probably a $1,000 trip for a week out there. I went to Dover earlier in the summer before my swim, and so that was probably another $1,500 trip. And then the cost of the channel itself, based on the exchange rate at the time that I was paying the fees, I guessed it was about $4,000 overall for hiring the boat, for paying the fees, for, you know, getting the physical, and then, you know, add airfare and some hotel costs on top of that. You know, it can easily cost $8,000-$9,000, including training and the actual cost of swimming the channel.
That's quite substantial. In addition to those costs, what are some of the things that you have to arrange in advance, maybe over in England, over in France, that it's not something that you can do within a short time frame?
No, it's really not. The channel swimming organization, the one that I went with, is called the Channel Swimming and Piloting Federation. And, of course, that's different than the old traditional one, the Channel Swimming Association. But they require that you have all of your paperwork in by the end of the year, before your summer of swimming. So basically at least 6 months ahead of time. And so you have to get, a physical. You have to do a six-hour qualifying swim, which just shows that, you know, you really are someone who's going to make a serious attempt at this, because
right.
they don't want people to get in and swim for an hour and get out. You know, it's not good for anybody. So you got to get in that six-hour qualifying swim as well, in cold water, of course, 6 hours
of course.
In 60-degree water. And you have to have a physical ahead of time. Then you have to line up the pilot. And some people approach the pilot setup different ways. Some people try to, you know, basically interview a couple, three pilots just to find out who you're going to get along best with. I just, you know, read a little bit online about things and picked somebody. It wasn't any big deal to me. And, you know, you got to sign up. You got to, you know, make your hotel reservations and plan out what you're going to eat, and, you know, it's a lot of stuff. I started serious preparations about 20 months before my swim.
Wow.
And there were, you know, every week, you know, there was at least a little bit I had to do to get ready that whole time.
Interesting. Now, I understand, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, that you can schedule your actual swim, but it's not an exact specific date or time. You're given an actual range, and you have to be ready pretty much during this particular range. So you never quite know when your swim is going to start. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, it's not even quite that simple.
Okay.
When you sign up, and I signed up about 18, 20 months ahead of time, they book these things really, really long, long way away. And you sign up for what's called a swim window. It's based on the tides, and most people prefer to swim on what's called a neap tide, because that's when the tidal currents are the weakest, which means that you don't have to swim across as strong a tide.
So, okay.
You know, you think of it like swimming across a river. If you start on one side of the river and swim across, you're not going to end up in the same spot on the other side of the river, you're going to end up downriver.
Right.
Well, the channel is the same way. You don't actually swim against the current, but you do get pushed around by the current.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little bit easier if those tidal currents are not as strong. And so people sign up for a window called the neap tide. And the neap tides come in about 1 week time periods, intervals. But the problem is that you, even if you're signed up for a window of 6 or 7 days, you only swim if the weather is cooperative.
Right.
And so my window actually started on September 11th, went from September 11th to 16th. But there were no good days for swimming that whole time. And so my window came and went without me swimming. And so I was still waiting on the 17th and 18th. And finally then on September 19th, we got a good weather day and I was able to get out. However, it was then during what's called a spring tide, which means I got pushed around an awful lot by the currents. It made it a little bit harder probably. But, you know, really the weather is the first thing and then the currents are the second thing.
Wow, very interesting. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners haven't even thought about those items that would affect your start time. Very interesting, very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
In preparing for this 21-mile crossing, this requires a lot of practice time in the pool and in the open water. As a matter of fact, you mentioned you had to schedule at least one trip to get the saltwater training as well as the qualifying swim. Could you tell us a bit about the workouts that you would do and what your swim schedule was like? Especially as you started leading up to the actual swim.
Yeah, I found that there's actually quite a bit of variability in people's training schedules. Some people just go absolutely crazy with it, and if they're at a point in their life and you know, their sort of personal and family and financial stability where they can do that, some people, you know, train heavy every day for 2 years for a channel swim.
Mm.
That wasn't my case at all. I could not commit myself, you know, single-mindedly to this until my actual sabbatical began just about 2 months before my swim. So, you know, I have a wife and two kids and a full-time job and lots of other stuff going on. So I have to fit my channel training. I had to fit my channel training in around all of that. And I'm 45 also, and so that you know, shapes a lot of what you can do in training as well. So I did an Ironman triathlon in the summer of 2008. So I was in you know, excellent physical condition coming off of that.
Okay.
And then after that Ironman, I just started committing all of my training to swimming. Gave up the biking and running and committed all my training to swimming. And from that time on, I probably swam about 3 or 4 days a week. And basically it was 2 or 3 shorter practices during the week, something like, you know, 3 to 5,000 yards. Almost all of it in the pool because it's, you know, northern Illinois. You can't do much else in the middle of winter.
Right.
I would try to make that pretty intense training, going high speed, long rest to really try to build muscle. And that doesn't help your endurance, but by building more muscle, you in the long run really do help your endurance. And then on weekends, I would do my long swims, you know, slowly building up. I think my first long swim was probably just maybe, you know, 3 miles in the pool. And then literally just slowly building up, you know, next week 4 miles, next week 5 miles, next week 6 miles. I got up to, let me see, in the pool 21,000 yards.
Wow.
which is a lot of pool swimming. I think that's, what, 13 miles, I think, if I remember right, in the pool. And, you know, that's like 6 hours. So that just gets really awfully boring. But that boring part of the training is important because, you know, swimming the channel is not the most exciting thing in the world when you're just swimming straight across and, you know, for 13 hours in the channel. So you have to train your brain for that kind of boring stuff as well. And then as it got warmer here in the, you know, spring of 2009, that's when I started trying to get outside as much as I can. I did some swims in Lake Michigan and up here in a lake up in Wisconsin called Lake Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went out to San Francisco and did a week of training out there. And that's where I actually did my six-hour official training swim.
Okay.
I went to Dover then in July for a week and did some training actually in the channel. And then I, unfortunately, you mentioned what was it like as I got closer to the swim. I had a serious setback. When I was in Dover, I had done my, a weekend of training, 6 hours on Saturday and 7 hours on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And during the seven-hour swim on Sunday, I injured my right arm. I pulled a tricep muscle.
Huh.
And I literally, the next day, could not swim. It was so painful. Luckily, I was just beginning a vacation with my family in Europe. I'd gone over, you know, to Dover at the beginning of that trip. And then I didn't swim for 3 weeks.
Wow.
From basically the middle of July to the first week of August. And I was really worried, of course, that, you know, all of my training was going to be a waste. I was going to lose my conditioning. And I, you know, I could, even when I started swimming again, I couldn't swim much. I had to ease back into it. And so from the first week of August, basically to the first week of September, I just tried to quickly build up again. I started a little bit at a time, got longer and longer swims. Luckily I found that I really didn't lose that much endurance, so I just kind of had to ease back into it, get that muscle working again, and luckily, by the time my channel swim came, I did some physical therapy. By the time my channel swim came on September 19th, it was really pretty well healed up again, so I got lucky.
Wow. So you're in England. The day's finally arrived. You get to go ahead. You first get in the water and start your swim. What exactly are you thinking, feeling at that point? What's going on inside your head?
Well, you know, I actually do remember standing on the beach and, you know, I jumped. What happens is that you start in Dover Harbor and then you get on the boat and motor down the coastline for about half an hour, and then you jump in the water and swim to shore. And so as I was standing on the shoreline, I remember standing there thinking, okay, this is it. And what was going through my mind was I was just so intensely focused on what I was about to do that I was thinking actually very little, but I just kept telling myself over and over, okay, you've been training for this for, you know, at least 18 months. You have built up a lot of energy and training and endurance and mental preparation in your body and your mind over the last 18 months, and all you have to do now is let it out slowly over the next 13 hours.
Hmm.
And so that's what it was really like. It was like, you know, a battery filled up with all of this training and then just trying to let it slowly out over the next 13 hours. And so that's, you know, that's basically all I was thinking to myself as I stepped into the water.
Interesting. So you get in the water and you start your swim. What was the experience like? What was going on physically and mentally, and what do you remember from that experience?
Well, I've kind of divided my swim into sections, and the first 5 hours were just excellent. I felt good. I wasn't cold. I started at 11 a.m., and the time of day which you start is determined by the tides, not by the sun.
Right.
And so I started at 11 a.m. It was it's an hour before high tide is technically what it is. And the first 5 hours were great. It was daytime. The sun was shining. The water was nice and calm. I wasn't getting cold. And that's when I really kind of just tried to take the time to enjoy the experience. I, you know, would pause once in a while and look back at the white cliffs of Dover and try to listen for the seagulls in the background and, you know, just try to really enjoy what was going on. And for 5 hours, I was able to do that.
Okay.
sometime between hours 5 and 6, though, things started to get a little more difficult. You know, at that point, I wasn't even halfway across, and yet I realized I was beginning to feel the effort a little bit. I wouldn't say I was exhausted, but, you know, certainly a little fatigued. And I don't know what it was, but I just started feeling a little bit worse through that whole kind of hours 6 to 9. And then especially at about hour 7 or 8, I really started to get worried because I knew it was going to get dark soon, and I had done some training at night, but really not a whole lot, and I hadn't done any real open water training at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really know what to expect or how I was going to react to it. And I was also worried when it gets dark, of course, the sun goes down, you don't have that warmth shining on your back. The top foot of the water kind of gets a little colder.
Right.
So for me, the one of the biggest challenges was, at least mentally, was the cold. And I was worried that as it got dark, I was going to get cold. So about, you know, hour 8, I was really worried about what was going to happen. I remember one point looking back over at the boat and seeing the ladder on the back of the boat and thinking to myself, that's the first step to laying down and taking a warm shower.
So tempting.
Oh, gosh, yeah. But, you know, like a lot of channel swimmers, what I did was just broke it down into very small bite-sized sections. And so for me, I would swim 400 strokes and then take a feeding. 400 strokes, take a feeding. 400 strokes, take a feeding. So, you know, I didn't have then 5 hours yet to swim, which would seem impossible. I just had to take 400 more strokes.
Okay.
And that practice pretty much got me through that really difficult time in the middle and as it got dark. And then finally about hour 9, I realized it had been dark for maybe an hour or longer at that point. And although I did get a little bit chillier, a little bit colder, that my temperature had stabilized. I wasn't going just spiraling downward into a hypothermic state. And so then things picked up a little bit. And the last few hours were definitely a slog, but they were kind of a hopeful slog. I mean, you know, I knew I was going to make it, and I really felt like, it was just a matter of time. It wasn't if I was going to make it. It was when I was going to make it. And so that was a more encouraging time for the last few hours.
What was it about the situation, the environment, or just the whole set of elements that made you so sure that you were going to finish at that point?
Well, you know, physically I started feeling good again. I don't know if it was something to do with, like, how many calories I was managing to get into my body, or whether it's just, you know, an inexplicable second wind, whatever it was. About hour 9, I started feeling physically pretty good again. Actually, hours 9 through 11, I was, you know, working hard. I was swimming faster for those hours than I was at the beginning or that I had done most of my training. You know, I don't know. I think that as I got closer, I could tell my original estimate of my time was about 13 hours. I wasn't focused on time at all. You know, it didn't matter to me if it took 15 hours, but
right.
I could tell that I was pretty much meeting that time estimate. And so I kind of knew a little bit about how much I had to go. And, you know, then it's one of those things that you just train your brain for. I mean, you tell yourself, okay, listen, I've only, you know, you've gone 11 hours. You can go 2 more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but if it's only 2 hours, you really get this, you know, this mental sense that you can make it. And I guess that's what I was feeling.
Towards the tail end of the swim, what was the first indication that you were actually getting close to the shore?
The first indication that I was getting close, well, you know, it was a little complicated because it was the middle of the night, literally the middle of the night. It was, you know, I finally touched shore at about 12:45 a.m., so the middle of the night. And because it was nighttime, I could see lights on the shoreline, but I couldn't really tell how far away they were. I didn't have any real depth perception or distance perception. And so for about the last, I don't know, hour and a half, the key signal that I was looking for was the lowering of the little dinghy from the boat.
Okay.
Because the guys have to, the boat that follows you across can't get too close to shore, so they lower a little dinghy in the water, and the dinghy kind of escorts you the last about maybe 500 yards into the shore. And so I just kept looking for that little dinghy to come down from the boat. It's like, and then at one point they started fiddling with it, but they weren't actually yet ready to bring it down. And say, oh, no, I'm farther away than I thought. But, yeah, that's kind of the key thing I was looking for, because I couldn't tell the distance, and I didn't know exactly what the time would be. So I just kept looking for that little dinghy coming down. Every time I took a feed, I'd try to, you know, look for signals that they were messing with the little boat. And eventually, you know, like I said, at about probably, you know, 13 hours, 15 minutes or so, they lowered that dinghy into the water and started escorting me that way. And that's how I knew I was finally getting close. But then the very end was a little strange because, like I said, it was the middle of the night. It was a new moon, so there was no light coming from the moon at all. It was pitch black.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I got within literally about 10 yards of the shore that I knew that I was there. I mean, it was really dark, and so I didn't know I was there until the very, very last moment. The guy in the dinghy, the pilot's assistant who was in the dinghy, told me, okay, you can try to put your feet down now. And he must have told me that three times, but, you know, I landed on a kind of a rocky area rather than a beach. And
right.
So I actually couldn't touch bottom until I climbed onto the rocks. So it was a little odd not knowing where I was until about 10 yards away from the shore.
So for the benefit of all the listeners, tell us what that last 10-yard stretch was like from the time that you realized that you were very close to the shore to actually making your beach landing over the rocks like you just mentioned.
Yeah, I guess, I think I've heard this feeling described by a lot of channel swimmers. The overwhelming emotion is just relief. you know, you're sort of just too exhausted, at least I was, to feel, you know, great joy and satisfaction at that point. So I remember thinking, like, oh, I'm there. And it was just great relief that, you know, first of all, that you can stop swimming because, you know, you're just utterly, totally sick of it. And you want it to be over. And so it's just relief that you can, you know, stop swimming, relief that you can get out of the cold water. So all that kind of just real physical basic stuff. But then also, you know, when I finally climbed up onto the rocks and sat down, then there was the relief of, oh, I made it. You know, it's kind of like I didn't let myself down. I knew as I was swimming that there were, you know, literally hundreds of people kind of following my blip across the screen. The boat has a GPS unit on it, and it's connected to a website. And so, you know, all the people who were interested in my swim, and I found it was literally hundreds of people across the world, as a matter of fact, all the way from Australia and Africa and all over here in the United States, people following my swim. And I just remember thinking, oh, good, they don't have to have the disappointment of me not making it. And then I have a picture of myself right after I got to the beach. You're not allowed to stay in France. You have to get right back into the boat and go back to England.
Okay.
And so I got back into the dinghy, and I have a picture of myself laying on the, you know, deck of the dinghy. And, I mean, it could be in the dictionary under the picture of exhaustion.
Okay.
I mean, it was, so, you know, after I sort of had this relief of being done, then it was just ultimately exhausting. I mean, it was incredible.
When did the magnitude of the accomplishment actually sink into you?
You know, for me, it was a little anticlimactic in that sense because even after my channel swim, The fundraising for the school in Angola was such an important part of this that I didn't really feel like I could kind of celebrate the whole thing until that goal was met as well.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I was glad to be done with it, glad to be done with the swim, but in a sense, the job wasn't over yet.
Hmm.
And so it wasn't until about 2 months after my swim, I was, you know, back here to my work and back on the job here, that I finally crossed the $50,000 goal for the school. And that's when I really felt like, okay, you know, in a sense, the job is done. So for me, you know, it wasn't just the physical accomplishment. It was the combination of the fundraising for the school in Angola. And that's when I, you know, I wrote on my blog that day that, okay, it's time for a happy dance. You know, that's when I really felt good when I crossed that goal.
Just based upon the experience that you've had, everything that you've went through, from the time that you first envisioned doing this to actually having accomplished it, if you were to speak in front of a group of prospective English Channel swimmers right now, what would be the most important advice that you would give to them?
I would say, first of all, make sure that you really want to do it, because if you don't have that absolute commitment toward this goal, then you're just not going to be satisfied with the outcome. So, you know, make sure that you really want to do this, because it really does eat up, you know, like we've talked about earlier, a lot of money. It eats up an awful lot of time. And, you know, that sort of points to the second thing I'd say, that even though it is an extreme challenge and you have to be utterly committed to your own success in that, you do have to keep it in balance with the rest of your life. You know, there were times when I had to sacrifice swims for family events, and there were times when, you know, I had to not get in as much training during the week as I was like, just because I'd been gone from home too much. And, of course, you know, you got to keep it in balance with your job as well. Channel training can eat up an awful lot of hours during the week, and you got to make sure that you can do your job to your satisfaction. And so you got to keep things in balance, even though you have this tremendous commitment to doing it. But then I would also say that, you know, it's worth it. I mean, it's so wonderful to, especially for me, having had this goal for 30 years, to finally get the chance to fulfill that dream was just really tremendous. And so in spite of the fact that it's a tremendous commitment, you really got to keep your life in balance, the sacrifices you make really are worth it. So it's a great experience.
If any of our listeners, Mike, want to contact you about either the swim or assisting you with the project with the school in Angola, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Really the best way is through the website, which is just swimmikeswim.com. I've talked about my fundraising in the terms of my original goal of $50,000.
Right.
Unfortunately, I have learned that the school is actually going to cost about $70,000 to build. So I'm still working on the fundraising in a sense, a little extension of the fundraising. So in a sense, the journey continues. There is, you know, a link to a donation page, and there's links to contacting me directly through there. But, yeah, swimmikeswim.com is the best way to do it.
Mike, this has been an amazing story of an absolutely fascinating experience. On behalf of Open Water Chicago and all of our listeners here in Chicago and worldwide, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
No, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
The preceding has been a production of Open Water Chicago. Be sure to visit us online at www.openwaterchicago.com.